Good morning. Thank you for coming. And also, I want to say it's wonderful to go last because you get to hear the excellence of the people before you. It's wonderful presentations and also inspiring that I think we're all trying to find innovative new ways to figure out organizational life and to improve health outcomes from the perspective of institutions. So we're all on the same page. Okay, as this title indicates, my colleagues and I are going to present four examples from our work in which we've applied complexity science and clinical microsystem concepts to quality improvement initiatives in practice, education, and research. Just by way of a brief background, the question comes up, why do we need a new theory of, or to work with a new theory of organization now at this point? And we all know that the US healthcare system has evolved in bits and pieces, and it's really not a system in the sense of integrated parts working together to produce a good quality. So it's gotten so fragmented and hierarchical and inefficient and error-prone that we're plagued with this question, how can we provide the best possible care? So there's a number of thought leaders and administrators and academics who are trying to see health care through the lens of complexity science to see if that will help us get to where we want to go. And it also, this use of complexity science has also been adopted and promoted and recommended by the Institute of Medicine to specifically apply change concepts and complexity science to the microsystem level, which is the frontline units in healthcare. So our work fits into this bigger picture. What's depicted on this slide is the traditional mechanistic paradigm in healthcare that has led to this fragmented, error-prone healthcare system that we have today. And linear organizational thinking definitely has its place, but this assembly line approach in which each person works on the one task in front of them in a belief that results can be understood in the end of change processes as predictable, it doesn't really help us today understand the complexities caused by the dynamic and systemic nature of certain problems. It doesn't give us a big enough global view. So I just found this diagram last night and I had to import it because this is just a reality check that our systems today, particularly this example in public health system of the 21st century, is very complex. I thought it was pretty telling, seeing all of these different dimensions on one page, that today's organizations are not like assembly lines. They're really comprised of multiple groups from different sectors, organizations, and competing interests, partnerships, and networks. So that old assembly line approach of looking at just one dimension, it's really impossible to improve healthcare at the system level when you're looking at structures and processes and trying to improve outcomes. You just can't see beyond the issue in front of you. So a newer complexity-inspired environmental care view looks more like this as complex adaptive systems. And what we think and others is that the complexity science may be a better fit for organizational life because, like the image on this slide, the healthcare system is constantly changing, evolving, and goes through periods when it's in great flux. The smallest unit in the system of a complex system is not a mechanized part of a larger whole. It is the persons themselves, the individual agent. Could be people in biologic systems, it could be virus in weather systems, it's rain clouds and precipitation. So all of these systems have one thing in common, that they're nested within other systems, interacting freely in nonlinear and unpredictable ways. Patterns of performance emerge from these self-organizing interactions between the agents, which then changes the system, and then once the system changes, it in turn again changes the agents. And this process continues throughout organizational life. So in a complexity-inspired view of organizations, quality comes not from centralized command and control processes, but through diversity, creativity, and the interconnectedness generated between individuals and their relationships to develop new ideas and possibilities for doing healthcare differently. So it's very different from the assembly line, and complexity theory gives us a new lens to try and understand these systems. So a clinical microsystem is actually a complex adaptive system. It's a frontline unit. They're found ubiquitous throughout the healthcare system. And the clinical microsystem is where the patient or the consumer meets the professionals, and they're interacting in relationships that could be focused on restoring and promoting health. Our work targets redesign efforts on these frontline healthcare units, which is consistent, as I mentioned before, with the Institute of Medicine recommendation in the Quality Chasm Report that clinical microsystems are the building blocks for achieving best-in-class healthcare quality. And you'll hear a little bit more about the structure of microsystems as we go on, but essentially there's five elements of a microsystem: purpose, patients, professionals, processes, and patterns. And by making the relationships explicit and understanding the interactions between these five components, as well as these five components in related microsystems and in the macrosystem, by attending to those issues in our change processes, that is what leads more so to quality outcomes than always so rational, linear decision making. So over the last few years, the clinical microsystem concepts have been diffused throughout healthcare. Redesign efforts, both nationally and internationally, and have been undertaken, this clinical microsystems redesign approach, from medical home models to primary care practices to community organizations, prevention efforts. So we're beginning to see, and this is like in the last 8 to 10 years in the literature, more and more using complexity science and microsystems. So the two elements that we're going to be emphasizing today that are sort of tenets at the center of successful clinical microsystem redesign include organizational learning. And what this means is that we're trying to get, we've already mentioned it, my fellow presenters have mentioned this, need to develop a systems view. If we're going to improve healthcare quality, we need to get beyond the individual problem right in front of us and put it in a broader context, sort of like the catwalk big picture view. So clinical microsystems help in that dimension of understanding our organization, not just adapting, but learning as we go along to how to improve processes and better understanding about how the system works. And one of the other central tenets of clinical microsystem redesign is that information is key, that we need to use information not just simply as data, but we need to translate that data into useful information for members of the organization so that it can be effective in helping with communication, understanding process flow as patients and the staff too integrate and move through the system, and also use this information. Microsystems and improving microsystems is a data-driven process. So we need to have data in usable forms that help us diagnose, monitor, improve quality, safety, and costs in healthcare. So our four examples kind of emphasize both the organizational learning and the importance of information in improving microsystem performance. So our first presentation is by Kathleen Thies. And we're talking now about the real projects that we're involved with.
Thanks, Toby. This model was developed in large part at Dartmouth College. It is now referred to as the Dartmouth Institute for Healthcare Policy and Clinical Practice. And if you saw Sunday's New York Times Magazine with Brent James on the front cover, he refers to Dr. Wenberg, who is the retired director of that program, and they also discuss the Intermountain Healthcare in Utah. This is the model they use. Geisinger, here in Pennsylvania, this is the model they use. And the three of us have been involved in working with those folks for some time in different ways. I work with frontline staff, so I'm going to explain to you what a true microsystem looks like, how it works, and what they're doing. This is a microsystem. Okay. What you have up here, the people in, you have the people going out. You have, this is their access. How do they get to you? Which is a whole issue right there. Right here you have, now that you've assessed them, the clinical value compass. I don't know if people are familiar with it, but I'll explain that in a second. here's your triage. You sort of put people into different areas that that you're going to be able to work with. Here's your people going out the door. Same compass, so you got your before and your after measures. Here's your processes. There's two types. The direct care process is what the patient experiences. The indirect processes are all those infrastructure things that go on so that the patient can get the care. So these are the five P's. So you have your purpose, the patients, your processes. Then you have your professionals. What is your staff? Do you have the right staff mix for the type of patients that you have? And how well does your staff play together in terms of truly being a team? Performance patterns, two types of performance patterns. One type is for patients, you know, all this up here. The other one is for team. How are you a good learning organization? That's really what it comes down to, and how you track that. This. Okay. This is the performance improvement ramp. What happens is the team gets together, they meet weekly for an hour, and at first, just like you would do with a real life patient, you do your assessment of your five P's. Who are your patients? What are your processes? What are your patterns? Etc. What is your purpose? Because do your patients actually fit your purpose? Sometimes there's a disconnect there. And then you come up with a theme. Now, I've been working with the Interdisciplinary Pain Management Program in our health system for the last 18 months. And when they first started this, I said to them, who are the patients in the pain center for this particular program, which is an accredited program? They weren't sure, and they actually had patients in the program who probably didn't fit the purpose of the program to begin with. This was painful to go through all of this. They came up with a theme. The theme was, what is the scope of practice of this program in terms of the services? And then they came up with global, specific aims, change ideas, lots of flow charts, lots of value stream maps, cause and effects, fishbone diagrams, if you're familiar with any of these. And this is highly structured. The meetings are highly structured because you've got doctors, nurses, physical therapy, the secretary at the front desk, all these people in the room, and you cannot count on the loudest person or the physician in many cases to be the person who assumes everybody's going to do what they want. And very often it is the secretary who knows really how best to fix something. Then you identify your measures, PDSA cycles, are people familiar with those? Plan, do, study, act. You do it until you get to a point where you can standardize things. Looks simple, very difficult. So this was their global aim, and it's structured this way. We aim to improve the patient entry and discharge process. The process begins, we identified the patients, okay, what population, and ends with criteria-based discharge. They did not have criteria-based admission or discharged. They had to come up with those based on best evidence and practice. They expect to improve, and they're doing it now because they have the CARF accreditation. And because they want to be competitive in the marketplace and take this regionally, that we're the pain center that people go to. So that's next. So these are the aims that they've worked on. New referrals within, you know, that they're going to have an appointment. And again, these are very micro. Scheduled appointment within 10 business days, designed for the patient's admission, and then the structured program. They've met all of these goals, all of these specific aims. But a specific aim has to have a measurable thing, a date, a time, percent. This is the value compass, if you're not familiar with it. Here's biological stuff, the SF-12. These are assessment tools. All of these, they had to decide, just like an experiment, what's our variable? Whatever variable we have, we're going to define it now and forever. Everybody uses the same definition. They had to build a database in order to put all of this in and then get all of it out, not only individually, but in the aggregate. This is why this takes, like, months. They thought this would be a short time. This takes months. The philosophy behind this is that this isn't a change project. This is just a new way of practice. They will meet until there is no more pain program, because there will always be something that needs to be changed. They will start looking at their performance patterns and say, you know, maybe the way we've designed this program, the components aren't exactly right. It never ends. Our job as healthcare clinicians is to take care of the patients and to change how we take care of the patients every single day, all the time. This is a high-level process map of their admission process. This was an early one. The final one is more complicated. The cloud means something happens here. We're not really sure what. We'll go back and look at that later. Each part, they had to do trial runs so that on Tuesday mornings, they met this morning, with a stack of patient charts like this, everything is in the chart where it needs to be. This is all within 10 days of the patient being seen. Actually, it's within about 8 days. And 3 minutes per patient, run through. Here's our inclusion and exclusion criteria. Yes, no. Okay, here's patient. Okay, what's medicine have to say? What's PT have to say? Nursing? What's, you know, frontline? Goes around, very highly structured. And this has been incredibly successful. I think that everybody was very pessimistic. So now, on behalf of Jean Harkless, I'm going to tell you something about how we teach this. And I've precepted her students at UNH.
You only have 1 minute. This is your third person.
Oh, I'm doing hers also. So well, let me go back for a second then, if I have 1 minute.
No, but you, for all of us.
Oh.
For all of us.
For all of us? Oh, I thought it was just for me.
No, it's just 1 minute for everybody.
Just quickly go.
Okay. Well, Jean's teaching everybody at UNH how to do this. There you go. And I'm precepting her students.
I think what Kathleen was going to talk to you about is the clinical nurse leader program. It's a new role evolving in nursing to the point where we're teaching system redesign in the program, and it's a new graduate program for nursing students to try and take these principles to the microsystem level. Anyway, moving on quickly. my project, I took clinical microsystems into the research arena. It's not really actually been done before, but my work involved trying to design a home-based primary care program. These are kind of hidden programs, and not a lot of research and publication yet on what this whole healthcare delivery system of taking primary care to older adults in the home looks like. So essentially what we did, we're trying to design a system with absolutely no model. We had the concept of it. So what we did essentially was take the microsystem model, we did an integrative review of the literature, found about 21 articles, and did a line-by-line abstraction of everybody's description of what their individual program was like. And by doing that, popped out a general model for home-based primary care. So the advantage in what this shows really is the use of microsystems for organizational learning. We couldn't design it until we saw the key components of it. So we used the 5 P's of our key component, the 5 P's to sort of hang on all of these different dimensions. So then we could go forth once we saw the model. It was our beginning understanding of how this system works. And we're continuing to use this model in terms of doing conceptual work on understanding homeboundness, what that experience is for older adults, as well as formulating questions and generating research hypotheses for subsequent outcomes research in healthcare. But we now have a model thanks to the clinical microsystems. And then our last presenter is Lee Faith, who has 30 seconds to just quickly tell you what her project is about.
30 seconds over time.
Okay. So I just... Okay, I did apply the clinical microsystems in the community setting, and I did it based on working with quality improvement learning teams that cut across different community organizations as part of the multi-state learning collaborative that's funded by Robert Wood Johnson. And the focus that we had for the learning teams was on reducing childhood obesity. And it was a It was a placed in a poor, very depressed community, usual comorbidities, lots of high-level diabetes, low socioeconomic status patients, and the project occurred in the federally qualified health center where they had electronic medical records. But what happened in the community was that there was no data, baseline data, about BMI in this community. The school nurses were measuring BMI, sending a high rate of childhood obesity, but they didn't know what it was. But they were sending this data home with the students to the parents. The parents were mad. Why are you telling me this about my kids? We've been to the doctors. The doctors aren't saying anything. So what they started with was identifying that there was a 13% rate of BMI measurements in well child visits in this FQHC, and they put together many processes which they fed back, that provided information to the providers, which they fed back, and after a year they ended up with a 75% BMI in the medical record, and they have self-management goals that are built into the record as well, and they have a change in the culture.
Oh dear.
Well, unfortunately, we don't have much time to go into detail about these specific projects. They're terrific projects, but we are limited in time. So yes, we're talking about health administration from a resource perspective, our first presenter, our theory perspective from our second presenter, a simulation using theory practice by our third presenters, and the same for our last presenters. So questions from the audience in terms of these individuals, and may you direct your question to the person to whom you want to speak. Yes, sir.
Yes, for the University of Florida International folks, how much is a simulation, and was it licensed, or do you have to purchase users?
We made it a part of the syllabus. It was a text purchase. I think it was $45.
$45.
And the students had to call there directly, so we didn't get involved in the money.
Okay, so
the handling of it.
So you
right.
Call directly to the company.
Right.
And how many students per group for the simulation?
There were about 4 to 5 students per group.
And you think 4 weeks is a doable time for them to do this?
Oh, yeah.
And let me follow up. With that, when you had your students, did you provide them with a theoretical basis to how to work in groups?
Yes.
So that they have a sense of what's going on?
That's true. You talk about how groups are supposed to work. But
correct.
So you're actually in a group, and you have a lot writing on it to actually see it coming to life.
Okay. Question in the... yes, ma'am.
Are your groups... most of our students aren't together. They're online. Do your students do it online?
Yeah, it's a web-based program. So they can access it at any time. They don't need to come to the university whatsoever.
So the groups aren't meeting as a group to do this?
Well, you can do it from a virtual group, or you can do it to where they actually wanted to come together. That was the option of the group on how best it worked for them.
Great. Another source of conflict.
Okay. Another source, yes, I can see. In the back, please.
I apologize. I just got into town and came in late. But my question, I think, is primarily for the New Hampshire folks, unless others spoke to this before. I work in health information technology policy, and I'm curious as to how you were able to separate the usefulness of technology to the degree that you used it to provide the information as opposed to automating things so much when we talk about implementing technology. I think the conversation goes down the path of automating things, and really it should be more about sharing information. So how did you find that in your implementation with boots on the ground?
Well, I can say that in the community-based setting, that starting with the identifying, getting the BMI information in the record, that was also part of a larger process of flow, patient flow, redesign as well, so that that information went ahead to the provider as the patients went through the process, so that they had it in order for them to talk about. They also did work with the providers in terms of motivational interviewing, so they had
getting there. But what's happening now, this, you know, the project that they just finished was really about, really focused on getting the structure in place. But what they're doing now with the information that they have is they are using GPS mapping to identify out in the community where the higher concentrations of kids that are coming through that have these high BMI measurements. And they're working with the stores, you know, the 7-Elevens, to look at what they're offering and their, that kind of thing. They're working with restaurants. And they've developed their walking trail information, you know, how far, are there bathrooms along the way, you know, just that kind of information. So that is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I think so. So it sounds like that the technology is primarily used to make the information available, and then there's a linked process to educate those working, the practitioners, figure out how to incorporate accessing the information and using it as part of their practice.
Could you follow that up by, you were talking about the systems approach, the input, the throughput, the output. I didn't hear much about the feedback loop. Is that what you were just talking about?
That's a piece of it, yeah.
I don't think we think of.
I'm looking at the large systems approach.
So as far as
with the black box that you first began, and I didn't see the feedback loop.
Well, because it's a way of practice. That, I mean, this isn't the microsystems approach. Because you have your performance patterns, you are always. It's a continuous. It is not change. It just is how we practice, so that we schedule at certain times, and then you have to go back to the people at the front line. It's changed from the inside out, but it's really practice from the inside out.
But doesn't that link into the whole PDSA cycle methodology?
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, so the whole, that's where that feedback loop kind of comes in.
Okay.
No, it's continuous.
I wanted that identified.
Yeah, okay.
I like the complete, from the psychiatrist's perspective, I need to be a whole.
The team, you know, works on things until it works for them. You know, rather than have somebody come in and say, do this, they say, okay, what's our workflow look like? And they're going to be moving to a new building in 2 years. They may have to change that workflow just for spatial reasons. So.
Okay, let's go to...
Yeah, on the same point, for your five piece for the pattern, either for the community example or the one you did at Elliott Hospital. Can you give me some of the detail of kind of patterns the group identified that would then feedback, I guess, this continuous way?
Well, they find that when they started, they had data to start with. So they've now defined what they want to be collecting, and they've just started seeing these patients. So they will be looking at, in about 6 months, we're going to look at all those things on the value compass and see, are we actually making any difference here? Are we measuring people at the right time? Is 6 weeks out too early? Do we need to do this 6 months later? Is our program too short? Is it too long?
So in theory, from those measurement assessments, they might be able to detect a pattern.
Absolutely.
Which then goes back and feeds into what they do different in the process.
Absolutely. And then you go back, and for example, right now, we've already had many patients say they want to be part of the program, but they can't afford the copay. So we're going out to the insurance companies, and we went to our own administration and said, how are we going to work on this? And that was a pattern we picked up in 2 weeks.
Okay. And some other questions to maybe some of the other presenters? Yes?
The question was for the same person.
Okay. So, another question? Okay, let's have your question.
Okay. The work is really interesting, and I can see how it would benefit the area that I am in. But how did you get, for example, the federally qualified health center or in your health system, the rest of the group, the hospital or the clinic, to buy into the process? Because you can identify that there's problems, but you have to have everyone actually want to use the theory to make a change.
Because they're part of it. And we distinguish that there is no such thing as buy-in. There's only ownership. If you have to sell it, they either accept it or not. Mm-hmm. And so if everybody owns it, it is theirs. So there is no buy-in.
But they still have to jump on board.
Absolutely.
The
micro, the meso, and the macro system all had to be lined up that we are doing this. Mm-hmm.
And in our setting, what happened was that we had the support of project. So that was the kickstart. And now they've gotten additional grants to pursue the GPS mapping and the so forth.
Regarding the aims you have listed there, it seemed like that was a big part of the day-to-day and how we get to this point. Who listed the aims?
The group, the team. There's about six people on the team.
Oh, okay. And how did you find that? Did that work out well? Did you really come up with these aims?
Yeah, and there's training that goes with this, and it's highly structured so that everybody is speaking the same language. Because otherwise, every discipline will sit down and they've got their way of seeing it and they're convinced that everybody else is wrong. And I have one team that's really floundering for that one reason. There's one person who's just, and we've tried to, but it works. It's painful, and it's not as simple as it looks.
Okay, your question.
Has there been any, just in terms of having the scope of the broad literature review, applications in working with community-based organizations that work with, right now working in prenatal care institutions, to work with lay educators as an extension of the team in Latino communities? Is there any application of this in terms of trying to bridge what we're finding as a PET between the community and in healthcare? It's one thing if you're coming in from them, but what about using this to bridge that? Is there research, articles with issues in this area? You're smiling.
Trying
to work really came out of the acute care sector. So
right.
These work extending into the community and mining research, we're kind of exploring to see how it works and if it works. How to do it.
It's a real brain. But there's a limitation there.
So there's not much published.
No.
But you're taking a totally new
discipline.
Yes. And this is the beginning of the publication.
Right. Actually, the Dartmouth group is pretty interested in the kind of work that Lee is doing, taking their model into another arena. They're really pretty acute-care focused.
Okay. One last question to the simulation group. Since you did this on web, and we're now learning about distance education, and they're dealing with the simulation, how do you deal with conflict in that area?
In conflict in regard to the use of technology?
No, the conflict in terms of the individuals who are doing this group work, group simulation. Or were there, you did say that there was some conflict, so how do you deal with when somebody is over here and over there and they're not seeing one another face to face?
As we had mentioned before, we go through that whole theory about group processes and the forming, the storming, and the norming, and so forth. And this is their opportunity in this safe environment to practice their leadership skills, not to come to us as mom and dad to say, how are you going to fix this? But more of how are you going to fix it? Because in the real world, you're going to have to fix it. So we're not going to solve their problems for them. They're going to have to deal with them themselves. And they do. They become very clever when they realize someone else is not going to give them their answer and how to get everyone on board.
Okay, we're running out of time. I guess you would ask. Let's see what
you're... I just have a related question to that. I subscribe to that too, but like last semester, I had a horrible semester because I had a group that was floundering and I kept referring to that, and they were so far, they couldn't get themselves normed in a right way. So have you ever run across that? And when is the right time for the faculty member to come to me?
Yes, I have run that, for many years as I've been in academia, and I always give the students the group saying if there is a individual within your group that is just not playing nice in the sandbox, they do have a right along with, but they have to justify it along the way as to why that group member is no longer a member of this group. Now they have to document that very well as if they were in the real world and they were going to go to HR or to their boss to say, listen, we are now a group of three because of all of these issues. And they communicate that to the other member. And the other member now needs to, or that house member now needs to visit.
I'm going to end it here. I think that's something we all have to deal with. I'm dealing with that. I have group work in my class, and I have to tell them to indicate which you want out of your group and let me try to resolve that problem. But since we're dealing with the electronic age and with the web, that's an issue as to how do you deal if you're going to have group work and people are not in the same location. Maybe we need to come up with some additional theories as to how you, and we will have these questions answered by the group after this. So please come and chat with these group members, including the researcher and the theoreticians, in terms of their talk. Thank you very much for coming.
I think you get good conscious processing in your